But then the question is, why irreverent? And I think that the reason for an irreverent, really the need for an irreverent history, is that any good history of these institutions means going beyond how they describe themselves. It means rejecting their own self-justifications and the justification of their defenders, which are, you know, chiefly the global 1%, to be honest. So the dictionary definition of irreverent, that is showing a lack of respect for people or things that are generally taken seriously, is thus required, really. It's kind of called for in this case to be effective in coming to real understanding of what NATO and G8 are, why they should be resisted, why they're coming to Chicago in May, and so on. So let's start with NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. The treaty itself was established in 1949, and it states that NATO members, quote, are determined to safeguard the freedom, common heritage, and civilization of their peoples, founded on the principles of democracy, individual liberty, and the rule of law. They seek to promote stability and well-being in the North Atlantic area. They are resolved to unite their efforts to collective defense and for the preservation of peace and security. Okay, peace, democracy, security, all noble principles. In practice, of course, NATO has trampled on all of these principles, breaking both the spirit and the letter of its own bylaws on many occasions. Back around the time of its founding, NATO's first Secretary General, an aristocrat, of course, Lord Ismay, was overcome by a fit of honesty when he described the real purpose of NATO with these words. NATO was to, quote, keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. In other words, the U.S. wanted to draw together all the various allies emerging out of the Second World War under a security umbrella to prepare for a standoff with the Soviet Union, which became, you know, the Cold War, but of course also to provide within NATO some sort of counterbalance to Germany, which after the Second World War was considered to be the sort of the economic powerhouse of Europe that needed to be kind of kept in its place, lest there be a replay of the Second World War. But the Cold War was really only barely cold. It threatened to turn hot on multiple occasions. And because of there were, I mean, the reasons for that are many, but one of them is the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, something that if you lived sort of post the Cold War, you may not have ever heard of, but it's known appropriately by its acronym of MAD, mutually assured destruction. And it was MAD because it drove the world toward a massive arms buildup. The basic idea is that so long as I've got a first strike nuclear weapon, so long as I think that you can retaliate against me if I use it, then we won't start a nuclear war because we'll be mutually assured that we'll destroy one another. So part of being able to assure the other's destruction is that you have to build up a massive stockpile of nuclear weapons anyway. And so basically that drove, that impelled the world along a huge arms race that led ultimately to a stockpile of nuclear weapons that could destroy the world many times over. But again, at least the first strike nuclear weapon could be retaliated against, and therefore we'd all be dead, and wouldn't that be the best outcome? That's MAD. So this brought the world, really, this doctrine, brought the world to the brink on several occasions of actually a hot war. There was the Cuban Missile Crisis being the most famous, and then, of course, the constant anxiety that some rogue general might take matters into his own hands and start a war. Dr. Strangelove, filmmate people may be familiar with. So there was the way in which NATO functioned during the Cold War, in which it never fired a shot, but was essentially coordinating the U.S. sort of projection, the projection of U.S. power into all of Western Europe, and deploying and redeploying nuclear weaponry all over that area in order to kind of create this mutual assured destruction scenario. Okay, so that's kind of covers the military side of NATO up from, you know, the end of the Second World War till the end of the Cold War. And I'm going to come back to some of the military stuff since then. But what about the other side? What about NATO's commitment to democracy? And I think there's a really interesting book if you're want to do some more reading about this called NATO's Secret Armies by Daniel Ganser. It came out several years ago, 5-6 years ago. And basically, the thesis of the book goes through some pretty amazing revelations, actually, that came at the end of the Cold War, of what were called the NATO's stay-behind armies or secret armies. And again, these were armies that were prepared for the Cold War turning hot, and they were meant to be in place to resist a Soviet ground invasion of Western Europe. And they were set up by U.S. and U.K. spy agencies like MI6 and CIA. And this is a quote from the introduction of the book. The notion of the project and the intelligence services undoubtedly began as an effort to create forces that would remain quiescent until war brought them into play. But instead, in country after country, we find the same groups of individuals, or cells, originally activated for the wartime function, beginning to exercise their strength in peacetime political processes. Sometimes these efforts involve violence, even terrorism, and sometimes the terrorists made use of the very equipment furnished to them for their Cold War function. Essentially, what happened was networks of spies that were setting up groups on the ground that could defend from a Soviet invasion, they made alliances with various right-wing forces, domestic political forces. And what was initially envisioned as a way to oppose the Soviet Union and a ground invasion became a way to wage war on the left domestically in those countries, in those NATO countries throughout Western Europe. Of course, this was a time in which there were large communist parties that had a lot of electoral influence, and so there was this sort of way in which NATO also then came to intervene in and undermine the very democracy that it was supposedly set up to protect and that its principles supposedly enshrined. So now let's look at the end of the Cold War. According to its own self-defense mandate, you know, that it was really just meant to enable the Western European countries of the United States to defend one another in the event that any of them was attacked, NATO should have been disbanded with the collapse of the Soviet Union. You know, the main sort of other pole in the Cold War was gone. But instead, the U.S. and other Western European powers sought to enlarge NATO, bringing in new countries, kind of encroaching and beginning trying to encircle Russia further. After 1991, drawing in various countries of the formerly Eastern Bloc. Now, today, NATO countries collectively account for more than 70% of all of the world's military spending. So, and the U.S. has nearly half of the world's military spending. So then it kind of begs the question, who is NATO exactly defending themselves from if they are kind of almost all of world military spending? But that's really exactly the point, that since that time, they've basically engaged upon a series of, quote, tests of NATO's military operations. First started with Kosovo, sort of on the edge, on the doorstep of Western Europe in the Balkans, and with quote, peacekeeping there, although some of the biggest episodes of ethnic cleansing in that war, the war in Yugoslavia that began in 1999, took place after the NATO intervention began and with its essentially turning a blind eye to it. But then, you know, the U.S. has gone on. I mean, you've gotten the NATO being the force in Afghanistan, even though it's largely the United States, but it's done under the aegis of NATO. And then, of course, NATO's intervention in Libya. And I want to try to come back to these here in a moment. I want to first say a few words about the G8, where am I at time-wise, and then a few kind of thoughts about what it means to oppose them and what they represent kind of more generally as in terms of the system, the economic system, political system, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, all right, so I want to turn to the G8 now. The G8 countries, which are the U.S., Britain, Germany, France, Japan, Italy, Russia, and Canada. You might wonder why Canada is counted as sort of one of the world's, and this is nothing against Canadians or Canada, but its economy is just a tiny fraction of really the rest of these countries. And the truth is that it was the United States that insisted that Canada be included in the 70s because they wanted what they considered to be a kind of unshakable ally in the context of the G8. So anyway, Canada is part of the G8. The G8 countries contain 15% of the world's population as a whole, but account for more than 60% of world economic output. They are at the top of the global capitalist food chain, I guess you'd say, and their leaders are meet regularly to make sure that they stay that way. And that means even if it means trouncing, you know, climate change concerns or workers and workers' rights and so on, that's really been they've never considered that an obstacle. Though it's been something they paid lip service to, they have to. I want to say something about that again later too. But the group of powerful countries that became the G8 got its start in 1975 in the context of a world oil crisis and global recession. And since then, the G8 heads of state meet annually. They are all committed to neoliberalism, which basically is, have people heard that term before? Or who hasn't heard the term neoliberalism before? All right, well, I will define it. The basic idea of neoliberalism is that let the market run everything. Let the market be as free and unfettered as possible. Get rid of any regulations, privatize state-owned firms and other industries, anything that might be considered a barrier to trade would be a kind of violation of the basic tenets of neoliberalism, and so on. And so that has really been the kind of guiding economic principles of the G8, and but especially the United States and Britain. You know, that was sort of introduced with, remember, people familiar maybe with Iron Lady, you know, the film about Margaret Thatcher, which kind of, she along with Ronald Reagan were the chief sort of driving force of neoliberalism in the early 1980s. And that's now been kind of generalized around the world. Now today, with the Eurozone, if people kind of have heard in the news, the sort of economic crisis, the financial crisis that has now produced a debt crisis. You know, what was initially a financial crisis led all the major industrialized countries, all the G8 countries, but especially the United States, France, Germany, to chip into bailing out the financial system, bailing out, you know, the biggest financial firms on the planet. That meant that they all took on a whole bunch of sovereign debt, you know, deficits increasing and so on. What does that mean then? It means they all now want to cut their budgets to solve the debt problem, which means cutting social services. It means cutting, going on the offensive against teachers and other public sector workers, cutting back on transit and so on. So that bailout of the world's biggest financial institutions is now being handed to the rest of us. We're ones being forced to pay for it. And that's really what the G8, one of the things the G8 is very concerned about right now, because they're seeking to figure out how they can get out of this economic crisis that has produced stubbornly high unemployment and all sorts of other problems since 2008. So, but the other thing that the G8 does is defend the profits of their own domestic industries against competitors. That means against competitors in the developing world. It also means against competitors in the other G8 countries. So, I don't know, to borrow a phrase, they're a band of hostile brothers. Sometimes they can collaborate with one another. Sometimes they want to rip each other's throats out. So when it comes to fixing the debt crisis in the Eurozone, for example, France wants Germany to pay more to bail out, you know, some of the countries that are saddled with a lot of debt, like Greece. Germany wants France to pay more. Italy wants Germany and France to pay more. And the U.S. thinks that all of Europe should pay more, right? So they're all trying to figure out how to basically screw one another in the context of solving the crisis. But however hostile they are to one another's interests, they generally find ways to make common cause against the developing world and against working class and poor people in their own countries. In other words, the 99%. So take, for example, the issue of agricultural subsidies. In 2005, the United Nations Human Development Report said that the basic problem to be addressed in the World Trade Organization, the World Trade Organization being sort of one of the many institutions that the G8 uses to get its way. There's the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and then the G8, when they meet, they talk about how to use these various international institutions as levers to try to pursue what they think are their own interests. So the UN Human Development Report said, the basic problem to be addressed in World Trade Organization negotiations on agriculture can be summarized in three words: rich country subsidies. In other words, that the rich countries, the G8 countries, giving subsidies to their agricultural sector, to their big agribusinesses, meant that these are really efficient. Well, they're efficient because they're subsidized. They can turn out tons of product and make a profit off of it. But as a consequence, it undermines the less efficient agricultural sectors of the developing world. And so the UN then went on. This is, again, written in 2005. They said, in the last round of world trade negotiations, which were launched in Doha, Qatar, in 2001, rich countries promised to cut agricultural subsidies. But by 2005, between 2001 and 2005, those subsidies actually continued to grow. By 2005, the world's richest countries spent just over $1 billion on aid for agriculture in poor countries. That's $1 billion they spent over the course of the year of 2005. That same year, they were spending just under $1 billion each day to subsidize their own agribusinesses at home. So you can see how they are basically saying that they want to fix the problem of famine and food and agriculture in the developing world, while they're basically subsidizing their own industries to 300 times the rate at which they're giving aid to the developing world. And that is what locks in that, you know, that inequality, that ranking of some of the more powerful nations at the top and the less so at the bottom. Some of the other things that that the G8 has done is, you know, just if people are familiar at all with the AIDS crisis, which is especially hard-hitting in Africa, the G8 has pursued, tried to stop the production of generic versions of AIDS drugs because they violate, quote, intellectual property rights. It's just another example. So that basically pricing these things out of reach of, you know, anyone but, you know, some of the richest people on the planet. Of course, they've also opposed climate change measures as barriers to trade and likewise targeted various laws that protect workers' rights and living standards and so on. So the annual G8 summit is a forum for the global elite to plan their use of these various institutions and to basically try to come up with some common plan to whatever extent that they can about how to manage the global economy and how it works. And what's kind of interesting is that today, some of those countries that have come under sort of the heel of the IMF, for example, the International Monetary Fund, are some of the countries of Europe that previously had been those powerful countries. That's the consequence of this debt crisis. So you see like Greece and Italy and so on now being forced to accept some of the same measures that have been pushed on the developing world over the course of years. Okay, so I want to say a couple last things and then open it up for discussion. First of all, I think the only way to understand the NATO and G8 summit happening here in May in Chicago is that it was a mistake. It shouldn't have happened this way. And let me say what I mean by that. Since 2001, when there were big protests against NATO and it was just the G8 then. It's almost unprecedented that NATO and G8 met at the same place. It hasn't happened since 1977, which is the only other time it happened. And that was in London. But in Genoa in 2001, there was a G8 meeting which led to 100,000 people in the streets, big protest. A protester was killed by police. His name was Carlo Giuliani. And that was right in the that came just a couple years after the battle in Seattle, if people remember the 1999 WTO protests there, and a kind of rising tide of global justice organizing and activism around the world. A lot of which was cut short and essentially disappeared in the wake of September 11th and the turn towards war by the United States and the war on terrorism and so on. I think that, and so ever since that year, 2001, all these G8 summits have been held in like out-of-the-way places that they could just put on lockdown where there would be no chance of protest or anything like that. Now, I think that it's likely that the planning, that the idea of holding the G8 and NATO together here in Chicago, in a big urban area known for a long history of social protest and so on, that probably was conceived of before the Egyptian Revolution, before the uprising of workers in Wisconsin this past spring, before, of course, the Occupy movement. So now, instead of having what they thought might be kind of a showpiece for Obama trying to reassert American influence in a world that was, you know, having an economic crisis and so on, and where they were, war in Iraq and Afghanistan weren't going that great, but at least, you know, they were flexing their muscles and so on. I think now you're looking at a situation where the sort of balance of forces in terms of what they could expect in terms of protest, but also the difficulty of holding together their various allies and so on, is just way more complicated, way more difficult than what they were really imagining. And this is, of course, coming right in the midst of the presidential election campaign. I mean, the sort of whiff of people who have heard some of the references, you know, Democratic National Convention 1968, way in which it, you know, torpedoed the Democratic Party's chances and so on and so forth. I mean, that happened here in Chicago, and there are certainly people that are anxious about that. That's, I think, going to be something that kind of just is in the background here as we talk about this issue and kind of prepare for this summit in the coming few months. I just want to say a couple last things as a conclusion, and I guess I'll leave some more of whatever, if we want to talk more about Kosovo, Afghanistan, Libya, NATO, or we'll let that kind of come from what people ask when we want to talk about. But I think the most important thing here is that, you know, NATO can't come out and say that their aim is to militarily encircle Russia and their other main competitor in the world down today, China. And they want to use, you know, NATO and ongoing, you know, build up militarily to do so. That does not sell well. You can't come out and say, we want to dominate the world. Won't you support us? Right? You have to say that you're for peace and democracy and all those things. Just like with the G8. And the G8 can't come out and say, you know, we are trying to figure out how to impose austerity and, you know, how to cut social services and so on without encountering a big pushback from the Occupy movement, from labor unions and so on. They say, we want global prosperity and equality for everyone, and this time we really are going to address hunger and famine in Africa. We know we said we were going to drop our agricultural subsidies lower, but we raised them, and that was just, we don't know how that happened, you know, whatever the thing. So I guess the point here is that, you know, they never come out and say that. It's up to people like us to basically puncture those justifications, to start with rejecting them, to move from rejecting them to voicing our dissent, to beginning to organize and actually, you know, make our opposition known, to the next step being to actually build a global movement that can go on the offensive, that can put muscle behind the demands of humanity, of the 99%, for a decent standard of living, for an environment that's not going to basically make life on this planet impossible to continue. Ahead of the needs of the 1%, we want to put, and ahead of the needs of the world's most powerful militaries and most powerful economies, you know, we want to have the you know, human need kind of be the driving force. And that's something we have to aspire to do in the here and now, but it's also a long-term project. And, you know, I guess I see that this summit coming here now, offering us an opportunity to begin some of that organizing and work now that we know will take us a long time to accomplish, but is nevertheless, I think, a worthy project that we should aspire to. So thanks.
You talked about intellectual property rights, you know, like you're smart, you know, a car, you know, manipulating here, doing whatever it is, and hey, this is mine. So I like a lot of the GMO foods and stuff like that. If someone tries to, you know, at least there's an open market or something. You have one person dominating the lemonade, you know, they're issuing out lemonades to the kids with the lemonade stands, you know. And I was wondering, what are you seeing to fight that, or maybe, or work with them, or, you know what I'm saying, is there something going on here? Because to me, it's just, you know, someone holding, you know, food, this is, you know, anything, military strategy or anything, if you don't have this production coming in, you can easily start out. That's an old ancient way of controlling your environment.
Okay. Are we going to take a several hands at once, or?
I think, but just go with this because I'm not.
Okay. I mean, if what you're asking is what my view on intellectual property rights is, I mean, is it something that we should honor or not? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the key word is intellectual.
Right.
Okay, and then when you talk about occupied movement, you go here and you get a little conflict going here. Okay, what I'm saying is intellectual is having a discussion without having conflict. You know what I'm saying? Not being like animal, being intellectual. Not what's the difference between a man and an animal. Okay, and then having a talk between two intellectuals, you know, an individual or a group. Most animals move in a group, but they're not individuals, very few. So what I'm saying is there something in between? I mean, if you go occupy, like here, G8, and you go there and you have a conflict, because that's what I see, you always get these conflicts going on. Mm-hmm. And it's used for, like, some sort of political, you know, in the media or whatever like that. I mean, is there always something, you know, is there something, is it within the movement, or are you, like, for instance, are you going to, like, have, like, here in Chicago, is this going to be a focal point where they're going to have maybe hydroponics going on, you got a lot of empty, you know, places, I mean, to implement, you know, I don't know, you know, I'm just saying, because when someone say, hey, here you are, and, you know, okay, what do we do? Oh, we're going to do the same old thing. Oh, we're going to do the same old thing. It's like Charlie Brown with the football, you know, just do the same old thing, and you got certain players that just takes off and then do their own thing, you know, because you talk about intellectuals here, the so-called 1%.
I think maybe we're going to just hold on that, and I'm going to let Kieran and
Caitlin
ask their two questions, and then maybe Eric can see if he can round those up.
Yeah.
So, Kieran?
But Eric, aren't these the people who are toppling foreign despotisms? Don't we hate despotism?
Right.
They the ones who toppled Gaddafi, isn't that good? Mm-hmm. Don't we want to support these foreign interventions? Mm-hmm. Isn't that good for democracy?
Absolutely. Wow. Are you paid by NATO? No.
I actually didn't have a question as much as a comment, but I'm not totally sure if I understand your question, but I think it's just, like, with the ordinance that passed this week, it's clear that the vast majority of us are being left out of the debate, and, like, a bunch of us went to City Hall to, like, try to get in to play a part in the discussion, I mean, knowing that we wouldn't be able to, but, like, trying to play by all the rules to, like, do what you're supposed to do to be, like, allowed into the democracy, like, of the city, and we're not allowed, like, even in the meeting. So just, like, this in the context of what Eric was talking about, where, like, they may be seeing it was a mistake at this point to try to host this in the city, and they're doing everything they can to, like, try to stifle dissent. But then they're also, like, making all of these struggles link up at this point. So it's not just about NATO-G anymore, but it's about, like, anyone who wants to be an activist in the city. They're sort of, like, putting us all on the same side.
Yeah. Well, just briefly about intellectual property rights. I think it's as intellectual property rights is sort of it's something that the World Trade Organization fights to defend, by which they mean that there should be the right of corporations to actually put a patent on or otherwise control the products of their, you know, of their intellectual labor, which means that even things that are like life-saving drugs, which could be easily replicated and reproduced as a generic or what have you, are essentially considered to be a violation, even though they're life-saving. That's the kind of the bizarre hypocrisy of the system that they're trying to defend. And so, yes, there are conflicts that arise out of that, but there are the conflicts of mutually opposed interests, really. You know, of the side of humanity and the 99% against the 1%, really. And I think that. I think that they will. There's all sorts of, you know, but what about won't that undermine innovation and creativity? Won't there no longer be any incentive to do so because corporations can't actually turn their innovations into profits? The truth is that actually already much of what constitutes R&D is funded by big universities. That's where a lot of the money comes from. These are basically corporations that are using intellectual property rights to privatize the profits that are actually the consequence of socially produced, socially made ideas and inventions. And I think to the question about NATO and Libya, I mean, it really, watching the sort of NATO bombing of Libya unfold last year was sort of a bizarre, my head was spinning anyway, right? Because here they have, you know, these beautiful photographs of Condoleezza Rice and Muammar Gaddafi, you know, yucking it up in the early 2000s, you know, after Gaddafi was brought in from the cold and made an ally in the U.S. war on terror. They continued supporting Gaddafi right up until the day when the Libyan uprising began, and then suddenly declared him an evil dictator that needed to be gotten rid of, right? And meanwhile, they were putting forces on the ground to try to make sure that the Libyan opposition would be friendly to the United States afterwards, before they actually made, you know, the final decision, yes, we'll go in and we'll bomb Gaddafi into smithereens. And they had other reasons too. I mean, yes, he had been friendly with Condi, and yeah, they were chummy and so on. But increasingly, Gaddafi had, and the Libyan kind of oil industry would beginning to exert a little bit more control over their oil production. And this has, Libya has, outside of Saudi Arabia and Iraq, some of the most treasured oil reserves in the world because it's very clean, I've imbibed the industry propaganda about it. But they had what they call light sweet crude oil, easy to refine, ready to go to market pretty quickly. And the other thing, of course, was the unfolding kind of Arab Spring, the uprisings throughout Egypt, Tunisia, and throughout the rest of the Middle East, really. And when the Libyan uprising began, the fact that Gaddafi dug in and created a stalemate of sorts gave NATO, the United States chiefly, but also, there was a debate that actually unfolded because Italy, Silvio Berlusconi had been a very close ally of Gaddafi as well. They were more inclined to let him be, and they, so they could continue their good oil relations there. But ultimately, they decided that it was better to dispatch him and hope for something better and actually be able to establish a way of putting a curb on the galloping, really, events that they were worried might sweep away a whole number of U.S. dictators that not just Mubarak or in Egypt or Ali in Tunisia, but throughout the region, from Jordan to Saudi Arabia and so on, Bahrain and Yemen. So, if they were intervening on the side of democracy and freedom, then it would be funny to think that they could just do so a lot more easily by stopping the backing of all these dictators which they're keeping in power. But no, they'd rather go on a shooting war. And again, it has been part of helping NATO to expand and project itself far beyond Western Europe, far beyond anything ever imagined when the treaty was signed, certainly in 1949, and even at the end of the Cold War. Sorry if I went on too long.
No, it's all good. So I'm going to go with three questions. So it'll do, and then Mundi, and then Mike, and then we'll go with the next three. So
actually, this is much related to what you're just talking about. You mentioned Kosovo, or Bosnia. I would like to, because my sense of that, having gone through the time period, very unradicalized, was that was actually an occasion in which they were kind of needed to help a lot of atrocities from continue to happening, and if clearly you feel otherwise, I'd like to know more about that.
Okay.
And about sources, too, of your...
Okay.
Mandy?
I was interested in GA, hearing it in the context of this larger system, because what seemed to me when I was going to put my own view on is that the system as it functions, let's say capitalism, is inherently a bit conflictual. And if any specific entity has a lot of power and drives all other competitors out of the market or crushes them or destroys their economy, it'll be bad for the system in general. So the GA comes in as a sort of locus for these people to resolve contradictions in order to maintain a certain style of power. And so this is not really a question, it's a comment. Mm-hmm. Is that the reason why they're here is to sort of maintain a structural whole or some sort of structural consistency, because if they don't collude and conspire, it's not going to continue. It requires this sort of node of communication. And so these meetings are very important for them, because what's happening in Europe with the debt crisis, what's happening here with the debt crisis, what's happening elsewhere around the world in terms of natural resources, if they're not going to collude and conspire, it won't work out, because the system itself isn't very stable without these collusions.
Yeah, actually, so mine is a little bit of a comment, maybe you can speak to it, and it's great to follow Mandy's comment, because it's kind of the same thing, which is like, when we're talking about NATO and G8 and kind of like why that's important for people who live in Chicago and people who live in the United States, you talked a little bit about the system, right? And what we're talking about is capitalism. Mm-hmm. And so like the way that manifests itself through the G8 and NATO and is very similar to the way that it manifests itself through this permeation in our culture, which is like there's this narrative that's delivered that this is some kind of like a natural system, mm-hmm. that like when you allow it to function, that it does, when you set the stage for it to naturally take its course. But then, the people who are delivering that narrative are manipulating, the playing field so that, because like is pointed out, like this is necessary. This is the only way that it can actually function is whenever the decks are stacked. So like there's this idea that like, rich people are rich because they worked for it, right? Because that's
really hard.
That's the American
really hard.
Dream, right? Like if you work hard enough, then you can prosper. And so that's kind of the same idea that is being manifested here within the G8 countries, mm-hmm. which is like, there's a reason why they're at the top, and it's just because they understand this kind of natural order instead mm-hmm. of the fact that they're actually playing a game for which the rules that they're creating. Mm-hmm.
You want to go ahead and
sure. Actually, I guess I'll just take them in reverse order then. I think that it's a very important point. That's the invisible hand, right? That's the started at the, just down the road, University of Chicago, School of Economists and so on. And the basic idea that not just the natural system, but the best of all possible systems we've happened to arrive at today. That was especially, you heard that especially right after the end of the Cold War, when maybe some of you were like three. But today, there's not quite so much triumphalism because of subsequent developments, economic crisis, and so on. But absolutely, there's this idea that the system. I mean, this is what neoliberalism is all about. Get all the barriers, all the imperfections away, and let the system just work, and it'll work great. Of course, there's never been a system. Capitalism has always depended upon huge amounts of state intervention, of planning, of regulation, of ways to keep at the minimum capitalists from like screwing one another over, if not screwing everyone else over. Yeah, they can screw everyone else over, but at least capitalists should. That's why there's all this stuff about transparency in banking. That's why there was so much horror, really, at the banking system as a whole. If you read The Economist regularly, which is a British magazine dedicated to neoliberalism and all things, you know, capitalistic, they love it, you know. But they were horrified by the housing crisis of 2008 because what they said, who can even price what these things are that are being sold around the world? You don't even know what it represents. So it was horrifying. And I think that they've intervened again in 2008 with the huge bailouts. There's no way to describe that except as really a form of, you could call it corporate welfare. You could call it, bailing out the rich while, you know, the homeowners pay the price. I mean, that's the basic dynamic that you can see them using. Now, and it gets to your point, too, about stability, right? The point is, this is all, they bailed out the system to preserve its stability. But what does stability really mean? I mean, it's said in such a so frequently that you almost forget to question what does stability really mean. It's like it just seems to be a good thing per se. But stability for their system means instability for the vast majority of people who live in this system day to day. Whether it means I don't know how I'm going to get to work, I don't know whether I'm going to have a job tonight, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I saw a guy, you know, asking for money to, you know, pushing a stroller with a kid in it. We need something to eat. You know, that's a pretty obscene form of instability, but it counts as stability so long as the system continues to produce profitability. Like I think was what you were getting at. And then lastly on Kosovo, without wanting to get into, there's a big issue that kind of dominated world politics for some time. In 1999, and again, it was, for people who aren't familiar, there was actually a bombing war of Belgrade, in which, you know, lots of people lost their lives, civilians and so on, and the idea was to try to stop Slobodan Milosevic, the Serbian president, in the context of the breakup of Yugoslavia, from going on the offensive against the Kosovar Muslim population, and really what was happening, there was a three-way ethnic strife that was opening up between the Kosovars, the Croatians, and the Serbians. And what the United States did and what NATO did was to intervene on the side of the Kosovars against Milosevic and the Serbs. And in the process, they created a stalemate and a NATO protectorate that exists to this day. So, I mean, talk about an ongoing occupation. I mean, you know, not only is NATO occupying Afghanistan, but it's occupying Kosovo and has been since 1999. But the biggest episode of ethnic cleansing of the entire war was the cleansing of Serbs from Srebrenica. And that was really, among all the different atrocities that were carried out, almost never gets talked about because it was carried out with NATO's backing and with NATO's rubber stamp. But for some people who want like more of a good something that kind of goes through some of this and in the broader context, there's a great book by Noam Chomsky called The New Military Humanism, Lessons from Kosovo, I think is the subtitle. It's very good, and it goes through a lot of this stuff. And then there's some other stuff that's, maybe we can talk later, because it's been a while since I've even thought through it all, but I can dig up some more things too. But I would definitely start with NATO's Military Humanism The New Military Humanism by Noam Chomsky.
I'm trying to think about the best way to conceptualize NATO. Mm. Like, I think one thing you can definitely say is a kind of world oil protection
syndicate
for the West or something.
Right, right.
I wonder, does the fact that the U.S. and the relationship between the U.S. and Europe seems kind of fraught, is that some kind of danger to NATO? What is NATO?
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I had more of a comment, and I wanted to go back to one of the things that Eric talked about, which is that it's sort of a mistake for them to be hosting this meeting in Chicago, and that it, you know, they weren't predicting the sort of mass uprisings all over the world would be happening when they were doing this. And it goes to what Mwende was saying about these meetings being necessary. I think coordination is necessary, and collusion and, you know, manipulating the system. But actually, this is, like, itself, hosting this meeting is an act of, it's basically showing off. It's like the world, it's a party for the world's elite. And, you know, it's Barack Obama and Rahm Emanuel projecting power and saying, you know, we are capable of controlling our own population, you know, directing the world economy through the crisis, crushing anyone who stands against us, whether it's, you know, social movements or competitors like China or Iran or anything like that. And so I think that going through what NATO is and what the G8 is and the role that the U.S. plays and that Barack Obama plays as the president of the U.S. is going to be really important in terms of defending the idea of protesting these meetings, because I think that, you know, when people talk about 68 and they talk about undermining the Democratic Party and the, you know, the fact that these crazy protesters were bent on anarchy and they, you know, they were nihilistic and they just, you know, destroyed U.S. politics for the next 30 years. And I mean, people will tell you all sorts of crazy shit to convince you not to protest against NATO and G8. And so I think that talking about what NATO and G8 is and talking through, like, these people are, it's the global 1%, but it's what they represent is war, militarism, austerity. Like, they are what's wrong with the world. And so if we're not protesting that, if we're not standing up and saying, like, you know, not only are we against all the things that you're for, but we're against spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to host this party as an excuse to militarize the city of Chicago. Like, I mean, people don't automatically think of, like, well, we should protest against NATO and G8, especially in the U.S. where, you know, the U.S. military just does what it wants. Whereas in Europe, there's more of an understanding of what NATO is because, you know, NATO is the part of U.S. militarism that, you know, France and Germany and, you know, sort of participate in. So I guess it's just that, you know, because this is an election year, all of us who, you know, want to protest against NATO and G8 and see all the problems in the world as stemming from, you know, the existence of this cabal of, you know, sadistic bastards, like, all of us are going to have to defend the idea that it doesn't matter what happens in November, you know, that's not our problem. Barack Obama is, you know, he is a full-throated representative of everything that NATO and the G8 represents.
John?
Yeah, I saw a bunch of folks were sharing an article that Bernard Harcourt wrote that got picked up by The Guardian on Facebook. And folks who may know the education community that organized this had an event with him. We'll probably do more with him in the future. But the argument of the article was like, you know, so, like, on the one hand, it's probably the case that they decided to do this before mass movements sprang up, you know, in the U.S. and elsewhere. So, like, it is a mistake in that sense for them to be hosting the summits here, but they're treating it as an opportunity, you know, in which we've seen in the last 2 weeks and what Rahm has been trying to push through, right? So, like, the argument of the piece is, he sort of applies the argument that comes from this book by Naomi Klein called The Shock Doctrine. The basic idea of that book is, like, for the 1%, every crisis is an opportunity. So, like, they want to use, you know, this like, scary image that they've conjured up of the sort of anarchist that comes, you know, from Europe or from elsewhere, you know, comes from out of town to stir up trouble, to, like,
from Naperville,
you know, pretty much bring to bear the entire security apparatus of the United States 1%, like, in the city, right, to crush dissent and to attack the idea that it's something that she can be within the bounds of normality to protest. So, I mean, I think Harcourt's argument is really right. My question stems from, like, well, what do we do? Like, given that they're trying to use the summons as an excuse to, you know, to attack the ability of anyone to do any kind of organizing, you know, which includes Occupy Chicago, it includes also, you know, so, like, there are three different city unions, public sector unions, whose contracts are going to be out in May, right? So the restrictions on street protests also apply to picketing. Which is yet another way for Rahm to push through austerity in terms of being able to, like, crush unions, you know, the few unionized sectors of the economy that exist in the city. So it's like, what do we, how do we organize between now and May? What's the connection between organizing to defend the right to protest outside of the context of NATO and G8 and the summits themselves? I'm asking this because I think that's going to be like a key question for us as a movement between now and May, both in terms of defending the right to protest and in terms of having the best, largest, most successful possible showing we can in May.
Do you want to do this?
Okay, yeah. Let's see. What is NATO exactly? So, I mean, I think the question is probably more about NATO since the Cold War, right? Because it's kind of understood what they were doing in the Cold War. And I think that the main thing is that in one way, it's continuing to fight against the main powers that were also in the context of the Cold War, the main enemies, quote unquote. In other words, it's still largely Russia and China that NATO is being used as a sort of wedge to try to hold off. And to give you an example, and if people recall that when Russia attacked militarily Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, a lot of that was Georgia thinking about joining NATO, i.e. switching allegiances from Russia to the West and then joining the NATO security umbrella, right? In order to protect it from and an expression of really understandable resentments against Russia that go back a long ways for having been a subjugated people under the Soviet Union, right? So in a sense, what's going on is that NATO's kind of continuing enlargement and so on is about the Western Europe with the United States trying to enlarge its kind of sphere of influence in order to kind of freeze out, isolate, bracket, whatever, the Russia and China. That continues to drive a lot of what happens within NATO. Now, of course, that cuts against what's happening economically, where there's even greater interpenetration and interdependence between China and the United States and Western Europe and Russia and so on, right? And so at certain point, some of these things, the sort of bill comes due or there's, it's hard to know how that all plays out. But certainly, in the short run, the idea of using NATO is helpful for the United States because it helps them share some of the military burden, the cost of it. It does help, like you're saying, to be the oil protection syndicate for the West around the world. And that's certainly been a lot of what's been happening in Central Asia with, NATO's done in Afghanistan and now the saber rattling against Iran and so on. So those things are all going on at the same time. But I think that really what we're seeing is, they've also acknowledged that interdependence economically. So there's the G8, but then there's also the G20. The G20 includes a bigger number of countries, including various of the Asian countries that generally fall under Chinese influence, in the sphere of influence. And so it's interesting also that at this moment they've chosen to hold a G8 meeting rather than expand a G20 meeting as they did in Pittsburgh a few years ago. And I think that has to do with feeling like they've got a lot of economic challenges that they have to kind of work out sort of among the Western European powers, the United States, as distinct from China and Asia. I don't know, that's speculative. I'm sure that we'll all read much more about this summit in the coming months too. We'll start to see now in the business press and even in the mainstream press in this city more discussion. Okay, what are they going to try to accomplish here and so on? And I think we should all keep track of that and point out the hypocrisies and so on that they've built up over the course of years. Because they won't be really promising any of these things generally for the first time. They will have promised them before and broken those promises before. The question about how do we best organize and what should our targets be? I mean, I don't know. That's a huge question, and I think that there'll be lots of big opportunities. In my mind, the thing that we have to get across is that our world. I recently did an infographic thing about Forbes. Forbes just did a report on about a year ago in 2011. There were some 1,100 plus billionaires in the world who collectively have $4.5 trillion in wealth. Now, that means 1,100 individuals have the equivalent of about a third of the output of the U.S. economy in a given year that they control personally. $5.5 trillion, so a little bit more than what they own, would be enough to address world hunger, lack of drinkable water, deeply indebted people, people living less than a dollar and a quarter a day, the AIDS crisis, and I forget one other thing for the next 20 years. So we live in a system that has obscene inequalities. It's something we know. And I just think that what we have to figure out how to do is how to puncture this festival that they're going to have around NATO and G8 with those sorts of ideas. And that could mean that we'll have a big march on May 19th, the weekend of their summit. But the weekend before, there'll be a people's summit, May 12 and 13, that looks like we're agreed is going to be hosted here at Occupy HQ. There's going to be presumably all sorts of things that happen that week. I mean, people can let their imaginations run wild. Maybe when they have 20,000+ police and security at McCormick Center to defend the summit, it's a decent time to go reoccupy houses that have been foreclosed on the south side or, you know, what have you. And I think that those are the sorts of plans that we'll have to spend the next months coming up with.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask a question and I'll go to Mike and put myself on start. Somebody mentioned earlier about how Europeans are a little more savvy than Americans about knowing the business of NATO. Well, I'm going to speak on behalf of the whole of the UK and maybe question the savviness, because in terms of, we were speaking about the shock doctrine and that Margaret Thatcher, in terms of shifting the vision of the left in England, applied the shock doctrine. But even worse was Blair that came after, which did not appear as a shock doctrine. It appeared as niceness. It appeared like, we have now multiculturalism. We now are embracing all our multiculturals, all our genders. And so he normalized the shock doctrine economic neoliberal policy. So people, it's like the boiling frog. People didn't know it was happening because ideologically, on a cultural level, these words, these memes, whatever you want to call it, were infiltrating our thoughts, even about labor. And when you think about UK and labor, you think, well, there was the Labor Party, right? So historically, there was quite a radical sense of being a worker. But now that's gone. And you will even find, I have personal conversations with individuals back home, and me, even with my American indoctrination, actually appears a little more radical than my work, you know, like. So there's something that happens after shock doctrine that also maybe is more invasive. And I'm thinking when I read Rahm Emanuel's victory speech, not willingly, but in order to address the alderman this week, and I noticed the amount of times he used the words security and stability throughout the whole thing. And he wasn't referring to war or G8. He was referring to just everyday lives. So I guess part of it is we have to be able to interfere with just the normalization of even those two words, wherever it is. You know, from the idea of, as anybody knows, when we were talking about moving into this building, there are a lot of arguments about stability and security, and these words almost had a hysteric effect on most of us. So I guess that's one view. And then I'll go to, it's Mike. Mike?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll have it. So, any more questions to?
So, I think my question is sort of a response to what you said. I mean, I sometimes feel sort of uncomfortable when we're talking about these sort of larger or world actors like NATO, G8, I think there's a tendency to sort of assume sort of what I would call sort of more giving these actors sort of more agency than they might otherwise have, and so which sort of creates sort of what, I don't know, some people would call sort of more conspiracy sort of accounts of how the sort of world system works, and in the fact that like there's sort of like these sort of actors out there who sort of secretly plot to sort of do things, which I think is problematic because it doesn't sort of highlight the sort of like systematic structures in place that sort of incentivize the actions that actually happen. And at least I believe that sort of ideas like the shock doctrine sort of diminish, like they don't really do justice to the actual like workings of the system out there, because it sort of simplifies it. Just says that there's like there's this active group of people out there looking for crises that occur, and then you sort of question these are neoliberal doctrines. When in reality, like that's sort of the that sort of scenario in which like a crisis occurs, that sort of opportunities for that goes both ways. It's not necessarily just like sort of neoliberal doctrines, right? And so I think, and I guess you could go further with that. So I don't know. I guess I'd be curious to hear more about like what these sort of ideas play in terms of like sort of public education and what we can do to sort of.
Okay. I mean, let's see. It's kind of a big question. I mean, I think that at one level, you're absolutely right. There's I think that to understand NATO and the G8, for example, it doesn't make too much sense to talk about them in, you know, if you're going to get into really the specifics of them as entities as a whole, because as I tried to lay out before, they have within them various players that have at various times want to rip each other's throats out and differences of opinion and so on. And I think the other thing is that the United States, as sort of the world's hyperpower at this point in time, has disproportionate influence within them, and so it's able to essentially use those institutions often to pursue its own kind of global agenda in terms of diplomacy, the economy, militarily, and so on. I mean, what other way can you explain why, how, you know, within, what, a month and a half of the World Trade Center bombing, there was, you know, a NATO invasion of Afghanistan? Obviously, the U.S. has huge influence in that. I mean, some 3,000 people died in that attack. It was horrific. It was on a massive scale. But in the 10 years since, there's no way, I mean, the United States and NATO have carried out hundreds, more than 100 times that level of just raw, you know, murder. So it's, you know, so at one level, right, there's just the system itself and how it works. And I guess I was trying to say something about that too. I do think though that, look, if you look at New Orleans, what happened in New Orleans after the flood, I mean, the way in which whole neighborhoods were cleared out and then left. So I went down to New Orleans to bring like aid and relief that like 4 or 5 days after it happened. And one of the things that was striking was that the whole neighborhood of Algiers, which is on the West Bank, which has actually survived the flood, but yet people were told to leave and then took forever for services to be turned back on. Essentially, it was coveted real estate. It was essentially, even though, and the Red Cross never delivered aid to Algiers in the West Bank, instead delivered it to the rural areas, other areas that were hard hit, but actually they could have set up a huge operation there and allowed people to stay in their homes. They didn't want to do that. That was because there was political and various decisions made about how to do that. And I think that is a... So the system may work in certain ways, but that doesn't mean that people with power don't figure out how to take advantage of situations where there's a crisis and thus an opportunity. And I do believe that our side can and should do that. But the problem is that it's the people already with immense amounts of resources that are best positioned to take advantage of those crisis moments. And then we have to be on guard and figure out how we can try to stand up to that. But it's a challenge. So I don't know. I guess I think though that NATO and G8 aren't the source of the problem. Like I forget who was that said that they more or less they attempt to manage the problems of the system to keep it functioning properly. And I absolutely agree that really and it's kind of why I was trying to say look, it's these institutions are do evil and bad things, but we could get rid of them and ultimately still be left with an evil and bad system that we also have to think about how to transform. And I so in that sense, I totally agree, yeah.
Kim?
Good. Just a comment on the way we discredit our observations with the use of the word conspiracy. Conspiracies take place all the time. It's a common practice in business, and occasionally businesses are caught at it, but mostly they're not. David Rockefeller in 91 admits that they were at a Bilderberg meeting where he's quoted and reported to somebody as he's speaking to the assembled press of the world that they could have never accomplished what they were working towards had their goal not been kept secret by the people they invited, the heads of the newspapers, etc. And he thanked them for keeping it a secret. They've been working on WTO for 30 years. How many of us knew about that, unless you traveled in those circuits or read foreign policy or the various think tank magazines that look towards a world system that emanates from the fact that the people at the top want to control things without having more wars. They don't mind making war on people, but the cost of World War II taught them something of a lesson they acknowledged. In 70, George Shultz, who became Secretary of the Treasury, I think, for somewhere high up in somebody's administration, and talking to his banking buddies, said that profits are too little in the global system, and we need to correct it. We need to take back the gain, the gifts that we were forced to concede to workers. They set out on a plan to destroy unions and eventually destroy the social services that were also part of the gives, so that there was some stability maintained in first world countries, especially the United States, following the turmoil of the 1930s. So they've been planning it for a long time, and they've been organizing. They have people who think about it all the time. And you can call it a conspiracy, or you can call it strategic planning. But they're thinking about it. And they're, you know, how, if you've ever read the Patriot Act, there's no way that that document was assembled within the few weeks following September 11th. And when it was presented. And so, you know, they're waiting.
You said a lot of what I was going to say. And I mean, I think just I would just add one more formulation to this, which is that the people who are the ruling class today didn't invent class society. But one thing you can say, and so that has to do with the way we produce and reproduce our existence. That has to do with economic modes of trade, of production, of distribution, of things like that, that are in a sense completely impersonal. Right? So to sort of peg the specific personifications of wealth as the cause of it would be to place the effect before the cause, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, and this is something that was, I hope this book will be translated at some point. There was a couple sociologists in France 2 years ago who, a decade ago, infiltrated Nicolas Sarkozy's social network and essentially documented the way in which the French ruling class operates. And they were sociologists, right? And they published their book. A friend of mine actually published it recently. It's called President of the Rich. And it's a very interesting study. It was actually a bestseller when it came out in 2010 in France, which tells you something about French intellectual culture. But one of the most important insights in it was that the ruling class acts like a class, which is to say they cooperate with one another. They identify a common interest. They play nice together. They have networks, incredibly tight, old social networks, right, that support one another. They understand mutual aid. They do all the things that we praise, but they do it for themselves. Right? They act like a class. And one of the lessons from the book is that, look, they know how to act like a class. Why don't we? And so their conclusion is that the ideology of individualism was only ever really meant for the poor. Right? That was an ideology that the ruling class has never lived in accordance with, the idea of sort of the self-made individual. This was not how the ruling class acts, and it's really something that has been divisive. And so I think that the idea of class conspiracy is not a conspiracy at all. It's sociologically true. You said most of that, but that's just another formulation. You know. So the question is, when will everyone else start acting like a class?
Yeah. Well, we are a class. I mean,
hang on a minute. Energy. We have a stack system.
Oh,
so
I'm for free open source.
I can put you on there. Do you want to go on stack, sir? Huh? Do you want to go on stack?
Well, sorry.
You want to be on the list to be called on?
Wait,
no, I'm good. I would just say free open source. That's all.
Okay. Well, would you like to be on Stack? I can put you on. Okay. Lady in the back, if you'd like to.
Yeah, I would just say that I think the conversation we've been having, and I just come in, so forgive me if I'm saying something that's already been shared, speaks very much to why we're here today. Why do we, as Occupy Chicago, care about demonstrating around NATO and G8 being here? Because we say the system is not okay. Because we don't support you enabling the 1%, the less than 1%, and keeping them in power. We want to be that community. We want to be individual, self-empowered, big community, and we don't accept the system as it is. We don't accept the structures that are. We know that we have common needs. We know that we are all human beings with inherent dignity, inherent worth, who need food, who need water, who need health care, who need shelter when it's cold and shelter when it's hot, and clothes sometimes may be okay. I mean, let's go back to the Garden of Eden, my friends. We can all be naked vegetarians and be a happy community. That's not exactly where we're going to go. But we're from that economy again.
Yes. Well, at one level, I think that the idea that they are always planning and they create crises in order to, or perceptions of crises in order to get what they want happens all the time. I mean, think about in this country for years, the education crisis, which everyone decried, you know, class sizes keep rising, performance keeps going down, and oh my God, we've got this horrible education crisis, but there's just really not enough money to spend on teachers. And you know, even though it would cost like $100 billion to refurbish all of the nation's crumbling schools, which isn't that much money when you think about it next to war spending, it's just there's never that money in the budget. Never could find it. And then the global economic crisis of 2008 happens and they find trillions of dollars to bail out the big financial institutions. And again, the education crisis continues, And now we actually have to make that, that's going to be even worse because now we have to pay off the debts from the bailout. But, you know, again, the point being that there was always a kind of artificial sense that we could never pay for those things even though it was possible to do. So I guess I just was kind of falling on that line of thought. As far as the last comment, I think that I think that I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but I think there's also a dynamic maybe which I'm not, maybe you agree with this too, so maybe I'm not saying anything that's different than what you're saying, but I think there's a dynamic whereby the 1% aims to deny us those things that you're saying that we all want. In other words, we can't just simply ignore them and go about creating that stuff here. And I don't think that's a matter of just our personal choices about whether, you know, how many jobs we work versus what we spend our money on. There may be people who are caught in such a trap of, you know, being upwardly, of having upwardly mobile aspirations and so on. But really, let's talk about the bulk of society has been stagnating or worse in terms of their standard of living for the last 30 or 40 years. That's not just a matter of a bunch of individual choices. That's a matter of a systematic process by which wealth has been redistributed from the poor and working class to the top. That's why the 1%, according to all of the figures, are experiencing dramatic rises in their amount of wealth, while our side is actually, again, stagnating or going down. Even as many more people have entered the workforce. I mean, over the last 40 years, the main difference in the economy is the huge amount of participation in the workforce by women. And yet still families find that their family income, so including the women who work in that household, has about stayed the same. That is a social process at work that is not the product of any one person's choices or individual judgments about it. And I think that ultimately that the system itself has to be challenged in order to help provide those things. I mean, so I don't know, again, I don't know if that's a disagreement or not.
Okay, gentleman in the peace shirt again, and then the lady in the gray shirt.
Just want to say a word about conspiracies. I absolutely essentially accept the frame of the Occupy movement in which the 1% or 0.01% or whatever it is contrasted and is fighting with the 99%. I think that's essentially true. I also accept the frame of the shock doctrine. I think that actually has happened, is happening, and will continue to happen. So there's no question in my mind that classes and people get together and do immoral things. I occasionally feel that folks should caution themselves against a type of thinking in which one denies that there is chance in the world and believes that all evil stems from one single source. There's something of a tendency I see among people to get into that mind frame. I would caution against it.
Do you want to go with me?
I guess I'm kind of looking at kind of combining what you guys were saying with what she was saying. And again, I just started getting involved with this, so there's a lot that I don't know. But the sense that I had watching from the sidelines all these months is that, for me, a huge part of it appeared that there's a huge portion of our population that seems to think that the 99% and the 1%, that the problem with that is that they're not yet in the 1%. That they feel that the system is right. And it will work as long, you know, if we work hard enough, we will be the haves. And that I think more and more the Occupy movement is, I think, beginning to get more and more people to understand that, sorry, that's not built into the system.
Right.
But I think that, for me, from what I'm talking to people of very different political ideologies, that's the sense that I'm getting, that's the point of tension, is that a lot of people just don't believe that it's part of the system. The American dream works. I just have to work harder to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's convincing them otherwise that it's a problem for me. And I don't know if anybody has any ideas about how to go about that, because I feel like I have, but I feel like I'm talking to a brick wall a lot of the time.
I just wanted to, it's not a question, but I want to speak to this question of conspiracies that came up. And I think it's a really interesting question. When I decided, when I went through this process of deciding that I was no longer liberal and that I wanted to dedicate my life to being a capitalist, and I asked some of the same question. And sort of investigating it drove the process of my own trying to develop a political understanding of how the society works. And I think, to make sense of the 1% and understand its behavior in this country and world over, you have to both deploy the idea of conspiracy and deploy the idea that there are conspiracies, there are multiple conspiracies that are happening within the 1% that are often in competition with each other to pursue very different ends. So I think you could see what's called politics in the United States in really broad terms as driven by a disagreement between two camps of conservatives, the Republicans and the Democrats, right? And the main disagreement between them is, the Republicans say, well, we're gonna screw everyone over and lie about it, and the Democrats rather do not lie about it. And the Democrats say, we're gonna screw everyone over and then say we're not screwing them over while we're screwing them over, right? And so there's this that's one big difference. But, so it's making sense of something like the economy, right? So you've got all these corporations. Each corporation is a conspiracy of the CEO, the CFO, and the upper management, right? But they're conspiracies that have to behave in very specific ways based on what shareholders, based on what shareholders vote for and what they see as their shareholders' interests, right? So there are certain kinds of behavior that are forced on them by something that's external to them. So I think to make sense of the 1%, it's a sort of a collective, it's a whole bunch of people that are conspiring to pursue their own interests that are opposed to each other, except when push comes to shove and say there are massive demonstrations on the streets, as happened in Egypt, right before Mubarak fell, then the entire 1% forgot all the differences and all the conspiracies united into one big one, which was, how do we crush this movement, right? So, there are, to tie back to, say, the G8, right? So you've got, people representing different countries in the Eurozone that all have their own interests, right? So they're all going to be fighting come G8 time to come up with policies and a strategy that will best pursue Germany's interests and France's interests as well. But they're also thinking, what are the interests of the entire Eurozone stacked against China's interests, or something like that, right? And they're pursuing their own interests, they're going to interact to figure out how they pursue their own interests. You get the basic gist, but I think it's both.
Okay. I might be conspiracied out, but... because at one level, what is a conspiracy? I mean, it's just a secret agreement or an attempt to negotiate, make a few people get together in private and then try to make their ideas that they've agreed on in private into reality in the world. I mean, that does seem to happen quite a bit, actually. in small ways and big ways. I don't know, is it a conspiracy that Newt Gingrich's wife started talking about open marriage the day before? I mean, I don't know, that seems to me like a good bit of opposition research that was actually deployed at a particular moment in a campaign. Is that a conspiracy or not? I don't know. I don't know how those things get done, but they certainly happen with regularity. Was it a conspiracy that suddenly the first lady of our dear, the dear departed first lady of our city was given a memorial service right before they were going to vote on our ordinance that we were opposing? I mean, that was rather bizarre. I think that the important point is that at various times, the system works beyond the power of any group of people who might try to have a conspiracy or a way of managing it to do so, right? And that's what happened when the economic crisis was created in 2008, where you've got a bunch of individual actors on their own through a process which of easy credit that the United States was going on to try to, make the economy run in the 2000s, to, the the work of mortgage lenders and so on, it created a bubble in the real estate market, which then burst. And the truth is that when it turned, when the economy really hit, there was nothing that anyone could do to kind of stop it. They could plug the dam at various points, and that's what they did with the huge bailouts. But now we've got all the associated consequences of those bailouts coming down on our heads, right? And so, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure if that adds anything more to the conversation or not, but I guess that's the way I think about it. There are times when you can actually try to agree about how to manage the system, but there's times when the system operates beyond the control of any of those groups, and you're then faced with how do we attend to that, how do we confront it, how do we challenge that as the 99%, as a movement, and so on. The other thing I was going to say was... Someone else made another comment. Your comment about how do we move... See, I think that's a difficult question. I mean, there are times when you can... I met a guy recently who was a military veteran who voted for George W. Bush twice, and who, in the course of deciding that things weren't going right anymore, started doing research on the internet and found that he was actually, lo and behold, not a Republican all of his life, but he agreed with, you know, some pretty radical folks in society, and he started organizing that. He helped start Occupy... It's outside of Seattle, but it was like this town to the north of Seattle, and he was like in the midst of the Occupy movement there. Okay, that's interesting. You know, I mean, that tells you something. There's something going on when a movement takes root and starts to shift ideas when someone from that kind of recent background is radicalized, politicized, and so on. But I don't know that there's any way to, you know, some people are susceptible to an argument. Other people, sometimes it takes them experiencing something that just jars them. And they are then forced into kind of confronting these questions on their own or collectively, even better, in a way that brings them into contact with these ideas. I don't know, maybe drawing someone of a friend that you're trying to persuade to one of these events where they can meet other people and start those discussions, maybe having a discussion with someone other than you. I mean, not that you're not, I'm sure, very good at it, but I'm just saying, you know, sometimes it just having a conversation with someone else that they haven't had that conversation with before. Matt, I don't really know, but I do think that that's the kind of thing that movements are, that's what makes them exciting, is that they're able to do that in a way that you really can't do after years and years of doing that one-on-one, suddenly are changed when you see lots of people moving in and to activity, to organizing, to a sense of collective self-worth and sense of purpose, you know?
Okay, three more questions and then maybe we'll do a couple after and then we'll round it up.
I just wondered how you would puncture the argument of people who would say, well, now, you know, it used to be G7, now it's G8, now it's G20, like maybe everyone should just get invited to the table or something and everything will be fine. Because okay. That's like a, you know, a lot of people.
Okay.
Calvin?
I knew I should not have used the word conspiracy. There's sort of misunderstanding of what I was trying to say. I think what I'm trying to say is I think there's a tendency to oftentimes just sort of, in terms of analyzing what's going on in the world, to sort of just be comfortable with just saying this person wants to do this and hence he's going to do this. And instead of looking at this sort of like, there's like emergent dynamics amongst groups. So sort of like what Kieran's getting at, like these sort of class dynamics, oftentimes when you go into certain social circles, people act in certain ways. When you become a politician, you act in certain ways. And I think sometimes even just when we're talking about, say, like, oh, it's the 1% trying to oppress the 99%, in some ways I feel like oftentimes a lot of people end up being just comfortable with that level of analysis and not really looking at, like, what's the sort of underlying dynamics that sort of creates a system whereby, like, other things, like, say, why does everyone like to sort of aspire to be the 1%? Why are certain ideologies sort of more amenable to certain types of people or certain groups, and why are these carried on? Why is it that, like, within, like, the Department of Economics, certain, like, ideologies end up sort of playing a more prominent role, and why is it that people sort of buy into these ideologies without being, like, cognizant or conscious of that? And I guess what I'm trying to say is that, like, sort of understanding, like, what are the sort of larger sort of structural systems in place that create these sort of things instead of just sort of being comfortable with it, an explanation that, like, this is how it happened. Like, I'm not sure how, like, giving, like, a single causal explanation of, like, how something happens instead of looking at the larger dynamics. Yeah.
Okay, one more question right there, and then we'll...
Yeah, I mean, I think I was, to sort of come in on that, I mean, I think that someone said that there's one world, and there's one water system, and there's one, you know, planet and atmosphere, and there's one world economy, and there's, you know, I think that the 99% and 1% slogan is a good way of describing how that world economy is, you know, pretty well organized in terms of who holds the political and economic power. But I think what Kieran is getting at in terms of the, you know, the, how organized they are and how they respond to a crisis, and then how, you know, our side is somewhat organized, but, you know, not nearly as organized. And we, you know, a crisis is also an opportunity for our side to get organized. I think one of the points that you were making about, you know, conspiracy versus how systems work, that I guess Eric sort of got into, is like, you know, things aren't going according to plan, like the ruling class's plan right now. Like they, you know, they would just assume that there's not, you know, there wasn't, that Mubarak was never overthrown, that, you know, Greeks were not occupying, Greeks and Spaniards and Americans weren't occupying, and, you know, it's like they're trying to respond to a crisis in of legitimacy of their own system, and so, you know, they, the way that they have to organize that, I think, you know, the way that they maintain their rule really is through a combination of, you know, force and fraud. Like, they repress anyone who tries to step out of line, and they try to lie to everyone else about what the legitimacy of their power and the legitimacy of the system. And it's like they have, you know, forces that are organized to do both of those things, but they still have to respond to the fact that, you know, this, the system is collapsing all around them, and they have no, you know, they have ways of trying to explain that, but they can't really, you know, explain it or fix it. And so it's like the opportunity that we have, and that, you know, this is the Occupy movement represents, I think, is, you know, more and more people seeing that there, you know, that there is, that's the way the system works, that those are the sort of actors that are destroying the planet, and that, you know, there is an alternative, which is all of us actually, you know, getting organized and coming together to pose that alternative to the system.
Okay. Well, first of all, I just want to say it was a great conversation, dialogue, discussion, and thanks for inviting me to come and speak today. I guess to start with the question about, well, how would you try to respond to someone who says, well, maybe the way to deal with this is just to invite everyone. I mean, I think that just, maybe it would be a way to deal with it. We could put it that, we could concede the point even to our friendly, you know, critic who says, well, why don't we just include everyone? Except there's a problem, which is that you'd have to get the G8 countries to agree to include everyone, and they're not going to do that. It's too embarrassing. It's too embarrassing to have these to have a meeting. That's why they have built into the United Nations, which is actually more of a broader kind of community of all nations, right? Well, that's why there's a UN Security Council where the five members of it have veto power over anything that ever comes up there which they don't like, and they use it. You know, I mean, United States. What is it? The United States. China, is it China that has it on the Security Council?
No.
United States, China, Russia, UK, France.
Anyway, there's five countries that essentially make up, you know, and they use that to overrule the General Assembly and so on and so forth. There's a reason why they're not going to invite the poor and struggling nations of the world to their summit, because that brings together these heads of state from these other countries to say, hey, what about us? Here's what we'd like to bring to this body. Which then puts them, the most powerful countries in that body, in the situation, the kind of embarrassing one of having to just reject them and say, we're not going to do that. We just don't see those as the priorities that we have. So I guess that's maybe how I would try to answer that if someone said it. I think that, you know, I feel like actually that's, this conversation to me was a great example of how we were able to go from, to get to the question of kind of the deeper underlying structures and the various kind of institutions which are around to manage them and what's their relationship and so on. I feel like this is a very good example of how we moved from starting with a short and irreverent history of NATO and G8, but actually moving to talk about all sorts of things, about the way that inequality is, and so on. And to talk about, to name the system of capitalism, we've done that, though we haven't really necessarily got into a larger discussion about what is it that makes capitalism work? I mean, in my view, and I think there's also differing views about that. I mean, in my view, capitalism is really, you have to understand kind of what it grew out of and so on, but it's private ownership of the main ways in which, you know, stuff is produced, where at the same time, the vast majority of people don't own those things. They have to go work there. They receive a wage, and the profits of their labor, they don't enjoy. They go to the people who own the factories. And that's kind of like a, and again, not just factories, also office buildings and schools and all those things are included in the system. So maybe what's needed is a teaching on capitalism, what it is and, you know, how it works and how we challenge it. I think in the short run, however, the thing that we can say is that the explosion of protest over the course of 2011 from the Middle East to Wisconsin and the Middle West to the whole country from Wall Street to Oakland and everywhere in between is a very welcome development because obviously for a long time these people have been getting away with it with, you know, kind of how they go about business in a way that has made them fantastically wealthy with very little in the way of any opposition. And today we begin to see the stirrings of our side. And what does our side really have? In the end, maybe the most powerful thing we have is that we just, there's a hell of a lot of us. I mean, we got numbers. We got a lot of numbers. Now, we also have challenges. We have the fact that many people don't see themselves as part, as one of those numbers, as a place that, this is a place where they can come and get their issues answered, find their needs, their aspirations about how to change things, you know, addressed and so on. And I think that we have work to do to reach out again. But I think now that there's a space, now that we're through the, well, I guess we're just entering the bitterest part of the winter, but we're thankfully no longer at Jackson and LaSalle, I guess. And I think it gives us an opportunity to really push forward. I think the spring and the NATO G8 summit is an opportunity for our side to do that. But then I think we have to look far beyond that to get, like Kelvin was saying, to these underlying structures and how do we go about challenging them. And I think that there's more work to be done both organizationally and also in terms of our ideas to kind of make that successful. So I'm glad I was able to participate at least in this small part of it. So again, I thank you for coming.
So, first of all, thank you very much, Eric. I hope we can get you back many times. And make your announcement.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So my announcement is just because I was really been involved these last couple of weeks in this campaign to try to push Rahm Emanuel and the city back and the alderman back around the question of civil liberties, civil rights in this city. And we lost the vote, but we won a lot of things. We got them to push a bunch of ugly stuff out of the ordinance, and we also managed to build up a lot more allies and a lot more communication between people who share interests against this kind of legislation. And I just wanted to invite anyone who would like to be a part of a further discussion around that. Tomorrow, the Coalition Against NATO G8 in Chicago is having its regular meeting, and you're all welcome to attend. There were about 20-some-odd Occupy people there, I think, at the last meeting 2 weeks ago, where we mapped out the kind of campaign, which then everyone went off and carried out, and it was beautiful to see it unfold. And we'll have, as I said, a further discussion about kind of what now after this vote, what can we do going forward? Do we want to challenge the ordinance? How do we do that? Should we organize a pledge of resistance? All these things can come up tomorrow. But it's at 2:30 Chicago, the Kent School of Law. I believe it's something West Adams, like 600. I'll look it up. It's something 500 West Adams around that area, and usually when you walk in, it tells you the room number because we don't know it ahead of time. But that's
so
two.
We had the meeting with the lawyers.
National Lawyers Guild meet there?
Yeah, the National Lawyers Guild does meet there. Yeah. Yeah.
565.
I'm looking it up. I think that's right. Oh, it is 565. Okay. Yeah, 565 West Adams. All right, sorry, thanks.
Okay, and I'd just like to tell you, tomorrow we have another teaching here in this room at 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. It's by Amy Partridge from Northwestern called Precarity Movements in Europe, and I'm going to read you the brief. This educational event will examine the notions of precarity and precarious labor by analyzing three approaches to the political mobilization of precarious workers: the unemployed, the undocumented, the underpaid, and those whose labor is fragmented, informal, and or invisible in Europe. Precarity is a new identity around which we must organize and unionize? Is it a set of conditions not linked to a particular working condition, but rather to an effective biopolitical terrain of struggle? Or is it an indication of the need for new methods of struggle that combine direct action with the appropriation of the means of social reproduction? So that is tomorrow at 3 till 5, and I think it may help with thinking on what we spoke about today. I think it extends that further. So please show up tomorrow.